Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never. And we're still going through Madison's notes. As a matter of fact, I've kind of gone through searching very specific topics so that we could hammer out, you know, why the president and the design of choosing the president was done the way it was. And they kind of clarified by going down these really interesting tangents on how the president could be corrupted by the Congress or what have you. So one of the things that we've already exposed as far as admitting states into the Union, it was already clarified why they needed to make sure that the states coming into the Union had equal footing so that they wouldn't actually have the perception that they, you know, had been taken the original states had taken advantage of new states coming into the Union. They're not second class. A sovereign state is a sovereign state is a sovereign state. And they talked about how they could actually obtain a lot more power and authority and actually, you know, either leave the Union or what have. So they went through these scenarios, and it came out that the best thing to do was to be fair and to treat everybody as equals. And this is how it was really going to go along. I mean, even over the slavery issue, they still hadn't settled it. And the posturing and posturing is still going on as we're talking about property and so forth. When we hit August 22nd, I think that's the final conclusion that they're not going to be able to eradicate slavery because of the three southern states. And so what they decided to do was to make it a state issue. And they made it so that the Constitution would protect their trade as well as provide, because, you know, they included the returning of runaway slaves and those types of things back to those states. And there's no doubt that the southern states were really trying to create this, I'll just say, this expanse, this propagation of a franchise across the South, that franchise being slavery. And as abominable as it is, what was happening in Europe and what was happening all around the world were very similar things. Where, I mean, slavery is unbeknownst to most people today, America did not invent slavery. I mean, if you go to the Bible and the Old Testament, you will find that the Bible's origins, the book of Genesis, originated while Egypt was still, you know, kind of coming out, or I should say still, they were still practicing slavery, but Israel had just come out of slavery. That's how long. And it actually had been a practiced process and a practiced control over labor for 5,000 years. So why is it that the academics and everybody in our education system and the progressives want us to believe that we're the ones that institutionalized slavery? America had nothing to do with it. It was a standard of labor, like it's a standard to use a belt to hold up your pants. Whether it's, you know, whether you see that as a racist thing or not, I mean, that's your paradigm. It was designed the way it was by the King of England. Go read the original draft, Thomas Jefferson's original draft of the Declaration of Independence, and you'll find that it was King George who actually dictated that we were to follow a very specific process that only blacks, where in England, there were all sorts of different slave types. So, anyway, you know, the truth will set us free. And when we really start challenging what we're being taught, I truly believe that the kids today in the school system have a great opportunity of receiving the truth and actually rebelling and creating a revolution that could actually backfire. not a revolution of disorder and chaos and anarchy, you know, by burning things up and so forth, but a revolution by using the Constitution and demanding compliance. I believe that a civil revolution is the way forward. And actually, I don't even want to use the word revolution. It is called interposition. I believe civil interposition by using the Constitution is the path and the process that we can actually show our children in the school system that we can actually undo this. The sad part about it is too many of these kids' parents, and this actually plays into this because I want you to understand, kids revolt against their parents. Kids actually look at the status quo and say, this is crap. So I believe that we're going to be hit with a generation, if not now. If it's not now, I believe it's any time now that there's going to be kids that are going to be in the school system that will reject it because they'll actually have access to the truth. And when they receive the truth and they go home and they tell their parents, you're messed up. You know, I don't even know if you're qualified to raise me because you're so messed up. Anyway. But that is inherent in the adolescence, youthful time frame and the makeup of a human. Even back in Thomas Jefferson and John Adams days, they actually spoke about the rebellious nature of the youth. So are we any different? No. And so this is why time is of the essence, because they can't allow the clock to turn, get past that top hour, because as it starts falling down, as the hand starts going down the clock face, that's where all of a sudden it starts gaining momentum to work against them. So anyway, I think we're still on July 19th. Yep. No, it's July 20th. This is where we're at now. And this is Mr. Governor Morris, and this is his response to Mr. Pinckney. And we were talking about the process of choosing the president, the corruption of the president, and so forth. And so Mr. Governor Morris had the opinion, or his opinion had changed by the arguments used in the discussion. He was now sensible of the necessity of impeachments. If the executive was to continue for any time in office, our executive was not like a magistrate having a life interest, much less like anyone having an hereditary interest in his office. He may be bribed by a greater interest to betray his trust. And no one, let's just look at Joe Biden, right? He may be bribed to betray the greater interest of the trust of America. And no one would say that we ought to expose ourselves to the danger of seeking the first magistrate in foreign pay without being able to guard against it by displacing him. So here's the question. How come Congress has not moved for an impeachment? He's given them reason by just basically trying to wipe out the student debt. That right there was a breach of the Constitution. He could not make that law. That's clearly right there in the enumerated powers of Section 8. So what's it going to take? Anyway, one would think the King of England, well secured against bribery, he has it as were a fee in simple whole kingdom, yet Charles II was bribed by Louis XIV. The executive ought to therefore be impeachable for treachery, corrupting his electors, and incapacity were other causes of impeachment. For the latter, he should be punished not as a man, but as an officer, and punished only by the degradation of his office. In other words, by removing him. This magistrate is not the king, but the prime minister. The people are the people are the king. Actually, to be correct, the Constitution will be the king. We, the people, are what institutes that, and we're the ones that have control over that. But it's not by the people via a democracy. It is by the rule of law that we create, and the Constitution being our king. when we make him amenable to justice. However, we should take care to provide some mode that will not make him dependent on the legislature. It was moved and seconded to postpone the question of impeachments, which was negatived by Massachusetts and South Carolina, only being ayes on the question. And maybe ye, Y-E dot, means the question, but that doesn't make sense. That's just as equal. So, shall the executive be removable on impeachments and et cetera? Massachusetts, no. Connecticut, yay or yes. New Jersey, yes. Pennsylvania, yes. Delaware, yes. Maryland, yes. Virginia, yes. North Carolina, yes. South Carolina, no. And Georgia, yes. So, I mean, overwhelmingly, yes, you know, the president, the executive should be removable on impeachment. So, obviously, that became a new addition to the Constitution. And so Mr. Gary and Governor Morris moved that the electors of the executive shall not be members of the national legislature, nor officers of the United States, nor shall the electors themselves be eligible to the supreme magistrate. And so they agreed with no contest. In other words, everybody unanimously agreed. Now, that's interesting. So, not eligible to the supreme magistracy. What does that mean? So Dr. McClurg, this is the first time I've seen his name, asked whether it would not be necessary before a committee for detailing the Constitution should be appointed to determine on the means by which the executive is to carry the laws into effect and to resist combinations against them. Is he to have a military force for the purpose or to have command of the militia, the only existing force that can be applied to that use? As the resolutions now stand, the committee will have no determination or direction on this great point. And that, actually, let me take this aside because this really brings out a point that we're going to be getting into when we hit the militia later on. By the way, at this point in time, the militia is only mentioned in passing. They have not dove into the militia. And as a matter of fact, if I remember correctly, the militia in the notes comes up like 75 times, something like that. And it's not until August where you finally get into the eighth, you know, time or the fifth or sixth time. And it's not till mid-August where you really get to where they're mentioning the militia heavily. They're talking standing armies and so forth. So the point I'm trying that I need to help emphasize is that the only way the federal government has the authority to execute the laws of the Union is to call forth the militia. That's what it clearly says in the Constitution. As we read the Article 1, Section 8, and it basically says that the Congress shall have the power to provide for calling forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union. What they did, because they started creating these laws that they felt, okay, you know, taxes, they had taxes from the very beginning. Now, when they created the income tax, they unconstitutionally created the IRS. Now, what I just said probably put every IRS agent, you know, put me in their crosshairs. And that's just due to the fact, folks, that the Constitution talks about executing the laws of the Union. If the collection of taxes is not that, and it's something completely different, then what is it? Because if it's something that's applied to every state, then the execution of it must be done by the militia, if necessary. So when they went off and created the IRS, what they did was they created a standing army. It's not a bunch of accountants that actually come out, because I will tell you, if you sit at the table with an IRS agent going through a detailed audit, the question is, who do you feel is in control? I mean, it is a very adversarial engagement, and it's not something anybody wants to experience, because they come with the full force, with deadly force if necessary. And that was never the design. I mean, it's one thing to say you have to comply, and do it civilly. And by using the militia, that's how it would be done. Because who's the militia? The militia are the people that are part of the militia in your neighborhood and your community. I mean, the militia is you. We have to enforce these laws. And so any sheriff and every sheriff that wants to state that they're a constitutional sheriff, they actually should take a stand against any IRS agent operating in their county. Because the execution or the enforcement of any federal law can only come by, because it says right here, show me in the 16th Amendment where they gave them the authority to form a collection agency or an enforcement agency. No, they just said that they can enforce it with legislation. Well, the legislation did not amend, because if they're going to change Article 1, Section 8, Subsection 15 to provide for organizing, or actually 14, to call forth a militia, then they have to actually state that in the amendment. But they're not doing that. They're basically going to say, okay, well, this is what the standards are, or what have you, and the enforcement still has to be done, or the execution must be done by the militia. They were never granted. To be clear, when we get into this, you're going to see why they actually forbade standing armies the ability to enforce law on a permanent basis. And so as we get into the ratification debates, we're going to highlight this. And actually, let me just say this too, because we're going to be getting into the ratification debate. So what's coming up in the near future, once we're done with this, we're going to kind of go straight into the ratification debates. And I'm going to hit the stuff that, you know, is all aligned with this, that's fresh and new. And then what we're going to do is just go through those states where the Constitution was, I'll just say, heavily debated. I will probably ignore the New York debates and all of the debates that just talked about amendments. If you want to go through those debates, then you can get those last year through, you know, because we had it from March, I think, into August, where you could, where we were covering the ratification debates. And so going forward, as we look at the next comment, Mr. Wilson thought that some additional directions to the committee would be necessary. The committee are to provide for the end. Their discretionary powers to provide for the means is involved according to the established axiom. And that's exactly what Mr. King said, and they adjourned for the day. The next day, Mr. Williamson moved that the electors of the executive should be paid out of the national treasury for the service to be performed to them. Justice required this, as it would be a national service that they were to render. The motion was agreed upon without any, you know, without any objection. So how is it that the electors today are not paid for whatever the, you know, their day of service or what have you? Now, are they? I don't know. I have no idea if they get paid. They probably, they, well, they should. But anyway, let me move down. We're going past July 23rd on Monday. And we're going to hit the electors with Mr. Gary. And Mr. Gary moved that the appointment of the executive by electors chosen by the legislatures of the states be reconsidered. Quote, Mr. Houston urged the extreme inconvenience and the considerable expense of drawing together men from all the states for the single purpose of electing the chief magistrate. On the question which was put out for debate, New Hampshire said yes, Massachusetts yes, Connecticut said yes, Pennsylvania said no, Delaware said yes, Maryland said no, Virginia said no, North Carolina said yes, South Carolina and Georgia said yes. So it was basically carried. So they were going to now look at having the legislatures choose the electors. In other words, they would select the electors. So this, we kind of continue on, and we hit the next day, because that was towards the end. There's only a couple more comments on Monday the 23rd, now Tuesday the 24th, and the first thing up in convention, the appointment of the executive by electors reconsidered. Mr. Houston moved that he be appointed by the national legislature. Yeah, that he be appointed by the national legislature instead of electors appointed by the state legislature. According to the last decision of the mode, he dwelt chiefly on the improbability that capable men would undertake the service of electors from the more distant states. Mr. Spate seconded the motion. Mr. Gary opposed it. He thought that there was no ground to apprehend the danger urged by Mr. Houston. The election of the executive magistrate will be considered as the vast importance and will excite a great earnest. The best men, the governors of the states, will not hold it derogatory from their character to be the electors. If the motion should be agreed to, it will be necessary to make the executive ineligible a second time in order to render him independent of the legislature, which was an idea extremely repugnant his way, repugnant in his way of thinking. Mr. Strong supposed that there would be no necessity, if the executive should be appointed by the legislature, to make him eligible a second time. As new elections, the legislature will have intervened and will not depend, when they mean intervene, the elections themselves will intervene whether those legislatures will be able to take office again. For his second appointment on that same set of men, his first was received from it. It had been suggested that gratitude from his past appointment would produce the same effect as dependence for his future appointment. He thought very differently. Besides, this objection would lie against the electors, who would be the objects of gratitude as well as their legislature. It was of great importance not to make the government too complex, which would be the case if a new set of men, like the electors, should be introduced into it. He thought also that the first characters in the states would not feel sufficient motives to undertake the office of electors. Now, Mr. Williamson was for going back to the original ground to elect the executive for 7 years and render him ineligible the second time. The proposed electors would certainly not be men of the first or even of the second grade in these states. These would all prefer a seat either in the Senate or in the other branch of the legislature. He did not like the unity in the executive. He had wished the executive power to be lodged in three men taken from three districts into which the states should be divided. Interesting. So, in other words, creating a committee as the executive, like a board of supervisors, or like an executive board in a corporation. As the executive is to have a kind of veto on the laws, and there is an essential difference of the interest between the northern and southern states, particularly in the carrying trade, the power will be dangerous if the executive is to be taken from part of the union to from which part is not taken. Now, he's making a very good point here. And so Mr. Williamson, and I'm trying to remember where he's from, is Mr. Williamson from Massachusetts or Pennsylvania? Let me see here, because Williamson is from North Carolina. So he's making a pretty interesting point. If we're a Republican form of government, that means that we're representative of the Republic. When we look at Congress, Congress is going to be representative of the people of the states. When we look at the Senate is to be representative of the states with equal vote, equal suffrage, protecting the state legislature, the representatives protecting the people. So the executive, who doesn't create law, he's only to enforce the law. Is it smart that the executive be a single man? Or what Mr. Williamson is bringing forward is very interesting. I actually have to say that it would be far more Republican to have a board, an executive board, than it would be to have a single president. Now, you'd have a president of the board, but he would be more of a chair and would only be the tiebreaker. I'll be right back after this. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. As a matter of fact, before I dive into this, because it really does bring representation. I mean, the way we choose the president is through representation by the electors. But is the president himself going to have loyalty to the entire nation? Or does he come with a predisposition to meet some agenda or to move an agenda forward for a very specific thing? You know, if you think about it, would we have been able to be dragged through the Civil War with not having a single president? In other words, had we had five, a board of five with a chair and, you know, the four other parts of the board, you know, the only time the chair votes, kind of like the Senate. That's what I was going to say before we went into break. The vice president, who is the president of the Senate, doesn't vote unless his vote is necessary to break a tie. And so it would make sense to do something like that, to where the president of the nation really would not have a vote other than the deciding vote. In other words, if the board can't all agree or get enough people to agree that this is what we need to do, and this is in doing this, this would absolutely make it far more representative. So how would we do it? I would probably say that we could look at the north side and the south side and the central side, you know, going across. So you'd have maybe three regions, you know, for each time zone. And that means that you have four time zones. We've got Hawaii and Alaska. It's a little bit different. So five time zones. And maybe two for five, right? That would make 10. Then the one president would be probably chosen separate out of all of them. I don't know. But my point is this, is the best way that we have a check on the passions and desires of, you know, moving this nation into war, moving this nation. Because who declares war? Not the president. And the president really shouldn't be saber rattling and, you know, saying, we got to go to war, like Lincoln did. The Congress has the power to declare war, and it must be by Congress to do that. So the president or the executive being the commander-in-chief of the armed forces. Well, should that be a single person or should that be a board that actually directs and dictates to to the Department of Defense how to prosecute that war? Now, if we have a board, it makes it a lot harder for some of the crap to happen that's happened in the past. And, you know, would America be better off having better representation and better checks and balances? I say yes. The best parts of America have come because of checks and balances. The only reason we're in this boat and we're in this mess, this soup, is due to the fact that the checks and balances are no longer being operated. As a matter of fact, it's all full steam ahead with the leftist agenda. And that should never have happened. Should never have happened. How did we get here? Well, corruption, money, and foreign intrigue, definitely. But anyway, let me get back to this. The case is different here from what it is in England, where there is a sameness of interest throughout the kingdom. Another objection against a single magistrate is that he will be an elective king and will fill the spirit of one, and that has been true. He will spare no pains to keep himself in for life and will then lay a train for the succession of his children, the Roosevelts or family, Kennedys. It was pretty certain he thought that we should at some time or other have a king, but he wished no precaution to be admitted that might postpone the events as long as possible. Ineligibility a second time appeared to him to be the best precaution. With the precaution, he had no objection to a longer term than 7 years. He would go as far as to 10 or 12 years. Mr. Gary moved that the legislature of the state, so see how far off they are on going down these different paths of the president? W. Cleon Skousen, who's gone through these, he pointed out that there was probably more energy focused on the selection of the president and more votes cast. I think it was like 60 votes regarding the choosing of the president, going back and forth, making these changes. And, you know, when you think about it, you know, that's probably the primary issue that they wrestled with, was this one issue. Mr. Gary moved that the legislatures of the states should vote by ballot for the executive in the same proportions as it had been proposed they should choose electors, and that in a case, a majority of the votes should not center on the same person. The first branch of the national legislature should choose 2 out of 4 candidates having most votes, and out of those two, the second branch should choose the executive. Mr. King seconded the motion, and on the question to postpone in order to take into consideration, the noes were so predominant that the states were not counted. The question on Mr. Houston's motion that the executive be appointed by the national legislature, New Hampshire said yes, Massachusetts said yes, Connecticut said no, New Jersey said yes, Pennsylvania said no, Delaware said yes, Maryland said no, Virginia said no, North Carolina said yes, South Carolina and Georgia said yes, so the yeses carried that the executive would be appointed by the national legislature. So it went back to that. That simple, that the House of Representatives were going to appoint, and actually, if you read Article 2, and if you read the 12th Amendment, if the Electoral College cannot form, the House of Representatives is to choose the president, which, had they followed the Constitution in 2020, forgive me for pounding, we would not have had Biden, we would have had Trump. Unfortunately, you know, what we're looking here is that the parties have basically seized control of the Electoral College, and they did this in 1854. Now, had we gone down this different path, I honestly don't think we would have a two-party nation, because it wouldn't be national elections anymore for the president. It would be by board, and then you'd always make sure that you had an odd board, that Congress would have to make the district so that they would be somewhat equal, right? Where you'd, you know, kind of divide up the states to where you'd have equal representation. And, you know, and then you'd have these outliers, like California would be, it's, you know, would probably have its own representation, possibly New York would possibly have, based on, but I honestly think it shouldn't be based on population. I think it should be based on states. So I would go down the path of saying 3 or 4 or 5 states would, you know, be able to appoint. And if it's 4, then we'd have an odd number. Either way, a board for an executive would be far better. And the question is, I mean, there's probably some downfalls, but you're not the downfalls are not nearly as bad as the character flaws of a single president. Joe Biden is an exemplar for how bad character flaw can be as a detriment to this nation. Same thing with FDR. Same thing with Clinton. Same thing with Obama, especially with Lincoln. So anyway, let me dive down to the next primary part that we're going to talk about. And this is, again, is of electors. So we're kind of in that the meat of the Electoral College, where they just kept on, you know, oscillating back and forth on this. And it's not that they weren't continuing to talk about it. They were. But Mr. Wilson then moved that the executive be chosen every blank years by blank electors to be taken by lot from the national legislature, who shall proceed immediately to the choice of the executive and not separate until it be made. Mr. Carroll seconded the motion. Mr. Gary, this is coming too much to chance if the lot should fall on a set of unworthy men. An unworthy executive must be saddled on the country. He thought it had been demonstrated that no possible mode of electing the legislature could be a good one, by the legislature could be a good one. Mr. King stated that the lot fall on a majority from the state, which would ensure the election of a man from that state. We thought to be governed by reason, not by chance. And you can, as you read through how they're trying to decide this one position, they're coming up with some things that actually becomes misconstrued by the people, like the election the residency of the president and the vice president. You'd be surprised how many people I talk to really believe that the president and vice president cannot be from the same state. As a matter of fact, when we looked at the position of James Madison was the Secretary of State under Thomas Jefferson, not the vice president. Why was the Secretary of State the odds-on favorite in becoming the next president? Because they were the ones that handled the foreign affairs. And foreign affairs was foremost, because that was the bread and butter for the federal government. That was their job, not the state's job. Mr. King, the lot might fall on a majority from the same state. Oh, we just read that. Mr. Wilson did not move this as the best mode. His opinion remained unshaken that we ought to resort to the people for the election. He seconded the postponement. Mr. Governor Morris observed that the chances were almost infinite against a majority of electors from the same state. On a question whether the motion was in order, it was determined in the affirmative, 7 ayes, 4 noes. On the question of postponement, it was agreed to without contest. Interesting. Mr. Carroll took occasion to observe that he considered the clause declaring that the direct taxation on the state should be in proportion to representation previous to the obtaining an actual census as very objectionable, and that as he reserved to himself the right of opposing it if the report of the committee of detail should leave it in the plan. Now, what would be nice is, where were the notes from these details of the committees when they went off and they created these committees and they'd go off in different, because as I read through these, the debates didn't take that long. So what were they doing the rest of the day? I mean, I covered a few days in just, 1 hour. They were actually going out and debating and discussing what to do and what to present as a committee to the body of the whole. Anyway, on a ballot for a committee to report a constitution conformable to the resolutions passed by the convention, the members chosen Mr. Rutledge, Mr. Randolph, Mr. Gorm, Mr. Ellsworth, and Mr. Wilson. On the motion to discharge the committee of the whole from the proposition submitted to the convention by Mr. Pinckney as the basis of the Constitution and to refer them to the Committee of Detail, just appointed, and it was assigned and agreed to, no contest. Now we go into the 25th, and this goes on and on and on. And there's probably a lot of really good meat here. And Madison, there's this really long dissertation from Madison. I don't want to belabor the point. I know I probably am. So what I want to do is I want to just basically state that when we look at how it was stipulated, the intent of giving the state legislature the ability to choose the electors, that was not the truth. That was not the outcome. So how is it that South Carolina continued to do it? Because all of the states, they didn't know how to enforce it upon each other to say, hey, this is what we're supposed to do. Were they going to go to the federal government and say, hey, we want to sue South Carolina because they're not allowing the people to choose their electors? The state legislature is. Well, it arises under this Constitution. Why is it that they never created the standard and had it defined? Why is it that the states allowed the choosing of the president to dwindle, then to finally be subverted by the party operatives to make party primaries and give the parties the control over the electors without amending the Constitution? Why is that? Well, it begs, the answer is really, you know, out there, because as far as I'm concerned, I think it had to do with money and it had to do with foreign influence. There were a lot of little factors, and we probably would see, you know, all of these little things that happened, because as we saw the Republicans in the 50s and the Democrats in the 50s moving towards this, I'll just say this war, I believe who was going to gain the most out of going into the Civil War and creating the insurmountable pressure from the North against the South to force them to leave the Union? Who would have gained to actually have that happen? Britain, because it would have actually destroyed the Union. So Britain was basically probably playing controlled opposition on both sides. They wanted to destroy the Union. And they did everything they could. And when we actually pulled back and pulled out of it, and then gave them the backhand of saying, we don't owe them a penny for them trying to, you know, undermine us by funding that war. And that's why they incentivized the Southern states in the 14th Amendment, that those states that joined the Union were not accountable to paying that debt. And that is what sent Britain ballistic and just into a frenzy. And this is when they actually started doing everything they could to create question about the 14th Amendment. They started undermining the 13th Amendment, the real 13th Amendment, not the 14th Amendment. And when I say the 14th Amendment, I say what you call the 13th Amendment. Technically, the 14th Amendment today should be the 15th Amendment. We actually have 28 amendments. And so anyway, I know it's just, it's, you know, that point where you just start rubbing your eyes and your face go, oh, anywho, as we kind of go through the Electoral College, there's a lot here. I've highlighted a lot of it. I would encourage everybody to read it, but for the interest of dragging the dead horse, looking at how the Electoral College ended up, we were to choose our electors, and the electoral seats were assigned to the representation. So technically, this is how it could go. Each state legislature could choose two electors because they received two electors for their representation. However, because of the 17th Amendment, that should now shifted because the people chose those electors. Even though they're actually representing the state legislature, I believe that the state legislature should choose their two electors, the state legislature, and that the people get to choose their representative, or I should say their elector, for the congressional seat where they reside. And that's it. that electorate comes from the area of interest, the area of the congressional district, and there's no choice or no winner take all. That is not constitutional. I'm surprised that the party didn't try to go down the path in perverting representation in Congress by saying, oh, well, you know, however, if you vote for the predominant voting for representatives goes in the, you know, in the column for the Republicans, then the Republicans get all the seats. If the Democrats, you know, get the preponderance of votes, 50% plus one for representation, then they get all the seats. Winner takes all in House of Congress, or I should say in the House of Representatives. That would infuriate everybody. So why is it you're not infuriated with the fact that it's winner take all with the electors? There's nothing in the Constitution that allows that. Nothing. So we're going to dive into July 26th. And on July 26th is where we return to the topic of property. And these things are really, I think, of high interest, because even though they talk about slavery, they also talk about this this concept of admitting states and so forth. So Mr. Mason of Virginia moved that the Committee of Detail be instructed to receive a clause requiring certain qualifications of land and property and citizenship of the United States in the members of the legislature, and disqualifying persons having unsettled accounts with or being indebted to the United States from being members of the national legislature. In other words, if you didn't pay your taxes, you couldn't be in the federal government. How many presidential candidates have we had that have had that problem? How many, or when we look at not just that, that you had to have, you know, land and property. The Obamas, I think they barely even qualified, right? I mean, they were given land. They didn't buy their land. And I think that we, you know, we'd probably have had to go through, you know, to say, hey, you actually have to earn, you know, your way into these offices and representations and so forth. I mean, think about it. We've had quite a few people that have, you know, haven't done anything to actually earn anything at all. I mean, Obama, what was his job? He was this side teacher at the University of Chicago. Anyway, he observed, now so again, Mr. Mason observed that persons of the latter description had frequently got into the state legislature in order to promote laws that might shelter their delinquencies, and that this evil had crept into Congress if report was to be regarded. Mr. Pinckney of South Carolina seconded the motion. If qualifications are proper, this is Mr. Governor Morris, he would prefer them in the electors rather than the elected. As to debtors of the U.S., they are but few. As to persons having unsettled accounts, he believed them to be pretty many. He thought, however, and there's some merit to this. You know, should you be able to vote in the system that you're undermining, you're not contributing, or what have you? This goes back to poll taxes and everything else. Does a person have a right in the federal government to vote and be able to have some say and representation just because they're alive? Maybe so. I mean, if you can go to war and so forth, maybe your representative, but not your senator, not your president. The only person you should be able to basically elect is the person that elects the people, or I should say that represents the people. The Senate still represents the state in accordance with Article 5. Prove me wrong. Article 5 still demands that there's no amendment that took that away. So what are we to do? I honestly think that there's some merit of what Governor Morris is saying, that such a discrimination, back to Governor Morris, would be odious and useless, and in many instances unjust and cruel. The delay of settlement had been more the fault of the public than of the individuals. What will be done with those patriotic citizens who have lent money or services or property to their country without having yet been able to obtain a liquidation of their claims. Are they to be excluded? Mr. Gorham of Massachusetts was for leaving the legislature the providing against such abuses as had been mentioned. Colonel Mason mentioned the parliamentary qualifications adopted in the reign of Queen Anne, which he said had met with universal approbation. Mr. Madison had witnessed the zeal of men having accounts with the public to get into the legislature for sinister purposes. He thought, however, that if any precaution were to be taken for excluding them, the one proposed by Colonel Mason ought to be new modeled. It might be well to limit the exclusion to persons who had received money from the public and had not accounted for it. And so anyway, so this actually started growing. Governor Morris of Pennsylvania was under the precept of great antiquity as well as high authority that we should not be righteous over much. He thought we ought to be equally on guard against being wise over much. The proposed regulation would enable the government to exclude particular persons from office as long as they pleased. He mentioned the case of the commander-in-chief presenting his account for Secret Services, which he said was so moderate that everyone was astonished at it, and so simple that no doubt could arise on it. Yet the auditor had disposed to delay the settlement, how easily might be, have affected it, and how cruel would it be in such a case to keep distinguished a meritorious citizen under a temporary disability and disenfranchisement. He mentioned this case merely to illustrate the objectionable nature of the proposition. He was opposed to much minutious regulations in a constitution. The parliamentary qualifications quoted by Colonel Mason have been regarded in practice and was but a scheme of the landed against the moneyed interest, those with their money in land and those with money in interest or in banks and currency. Mr. Pinckney and General Pinckney moved to insert by way of amendment the words judiciary and executive as to extend the qualifications to those departments, which was agreed to, no contest. Mr. Gary of Massachusetts thought, now, see, they're talking about having some form of prerequisite that you had to have land, you had to be good on your payments and all of this, that the inconveniency of excluding a few worthy individuals who might be public debtors or have unsettled accounts ought not to be put to in a scale against the public advantages of the regulation that the motion did not go far enough. In other words, now Mr. Gary of Massachusetts saying maybe we need to consider adding more to this and disqualifying people. Very interesting concepts of how they looked at property, wealth, and representation. We're going through the notes. We'll be back through this tomorrow. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.